Hello and welcome to the TAA teleconference, How to Craft a Winning Textbook Proposal, presented by Mary Ellen Lapianca, Higher Education Developmental Editor and founder of Atlantic Path Publishing. Mary Ellen is a developmental editor in higher education and has worked with many major textbook publishers, such as Allen & Bacon, Prentice Hall, McGraw-Hill, Wiley, Houghton Mifflin, Sage, and others. She is also the founder of Atlantic Path Publishing in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and author of Writing and Developing Your College Textbook, Second Edition, 2008, and Writing and Developing College Textbook Supplements, 2005. Mary Ellen is a proud member of TAA, and her company is also sponsoring TAA's 2009 conference in San Antonio. I will email all participants Mary Ellen's contact information following the teleconference if you want to ask her any additional questions following the teleconference. She has been gracious enough to say that she would do that. So I now turn the teleconference over to Mary Ellen.
Well, thank you, Kim. That was a lovely introduction. I should just say that it's Gloucester, Massachusetts, as in Shakespeare.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's okay. Everybody gets messed up on that. You also pronounced my name correctly, which was good. That is another thing that gets messed up often. I think this is an excellent topic for a teleconference because I think most authors who have no direct experience with publishing are kind of mystified about the application process and the reasons for acceptance or rejection and whatever. And there are a lot of myths surrounding this area because it is such an unknown. Most of the publishing houses do send out a form that they generate in-house that has categories for all the things they want to hear from you or get from you in a prospectus or in a textbook proposal or an academic book proposal. And the idea is that you're to fill in the blanks and send it in. But the forms don't really explain what the underlying needs or expectations or concerns are that underlie those items that are on the form. And I thought I would try to shed light on some of those. I think one of the most misunderstood aspects is that the academic author naturally is most concerned about their content and their particular approach to their content for the course that they're serving. And this actually is not at the top of the list for the publishers. The very first thing that they want to know is whether or not you have a marketable product, whether or not it's competitive, and whether or not they can count on having it over a number of editions. So those are the top three things. I'm talking here about commercial publishers, and it may well be that nonprofit publishers and open access or open source publishers will put content at the very top of the agenda rather than things relating to market factors. And, of course, it seems odd to be talking about the market in the present financial climate, and I make no apologies for them. But just to try to clarify what the commercial publishers normally do and have done in the past. And here the question is, what is meant by marketable? And for example, for a college textbook market, a marketable product is going to be one for which there already exists a market. It's not a new subject, it's not a new slant on a subject, it's not a radically different approach to a subject. There's already a course in the course catalog of colleges nationwide that list this course. It may be as introduction to psychology, or it may be as teaching mathematics to middle school students, or it may be as whatever it is, but there's either an introductory or a second tier course or a graduate level course or seminar that has this, that covers that topic and has that name. That's the only way that the commercial publishers can identify their markets, and that is in terms of the course catalogs of the institutions of higher learning nationwide. A little bit different for academic and scholarly books, and if some of you who are on here are more involved with that aspect of things, I'll be glad to come back to that. What makes a book competitive? Well, it's competitive if it will take market share from the other books out there that are also used for that course. That they're looking to see what does your book have that's special or different or unique or that is a particular draw that would entice a user of another textbook for the same course to switch to yours. And then what about you? Can they count on you to be there? They want to try to get 10 editions anyway. And if it's a 3-year revision cycle, they're looking at 30 years. You're looking at 30 years of commitment. If the book is successful, if the book is not successful, then they will not be looking for extra editions. But for a successful book, they want to be sure that they are going to be able to generate profits from the book over an extended period of time. And, of course, how is a book profitable? It's the same way as in any other market situation, and that is that it earns back its costs within the first year being out there, and then in the second year, and hopefully before the second year, actually begins to make money for the publisher and for the author. And there's a lot that detracts from profit, which is actually another whole subject, but it is another area where there's a lot of lack of information among authors and a lot of myths surrounding profit. Industry research, if you look at the statistics, their profit margins are usually hovering around the 7-8% mark. And if they get above 10%, they immediately go to the top of the list of successful publishers. So they are not raking in the dough here on these books. Those are the chief concerns that underlie the forms that they pass out asking you what to fill in for your book proposal. If it's a nonprofit publisher, then they're going to focus more on matters relating to content and authority. They need to know that you are known in your field, that you're expert, you're credible as an author, and that your book is going to come out in a timely way, at the right time, it will hit its market, and they will be able to earn back their investment. Now, to be known, expert, or credible means having proper institutional affiliation, and the commercial publishers simply won't look at independent scholars, unfortunately, and people who are not, firmly ensconced in an institution with institutional affiliation, because that's the chief way that they can convince their market that they have an authoritative product. And it also gives them a sure market to begin with, which would be your own school. They often are looking for authors, who fit an author profile, and I guess I have that listed later, so I'll save that. I'm trying to follow my own outline here that I sent you without getting too far afield. Your book is timely if it will come out within a certain period of time. All of the publishing contracts refer to the phrase time is of the essence. And this relates to the fact that there is a publishing cycle and there also is an academic cycle, and those cycles coincide at certain points, and your book has to hit at the right time or be ready at the right time for its market. And if it isn't ready for the right time, it's dead at the gate because it's going to lose an entire semester's worth of sales. So when the figures come back in, the publisher will note that the book didn't sell well. And the marketing manager can say, oh, but the book didn't come out in time. It lost its opportunity for a semester's worth of sales. That doesn't cut it with the publisher. The publisher has to be involved with the bottom line. And they may choose at that point to pull the book or not have it revised, not ask for it to be revised, because they feel it wasn't successful enough. So their sensitivity to time and their tendency to be, to panic over schedules and deadlines is based in reality. If they have a good book, they want it to be successful, especially your editors who are working with you. But if it's not out there competing in its market, in the first semester of its copyright year, then they have failed, and very likely the publisher will not continue to support publication of that book. So these are things that you know one might not know. And books earn back their investment when the plant costs have been paid back. The plant costs include the cost of producing and manufacturing the book and everything that the publisher paid for. If the publisher paid for permissions, if the publisher paid for art research or photo research, if the publisher paid for outside indexing or a packager or whatever, all those are included in plant costs. And some publishers, smaller publishers especially, will pass these costs right back to the author up front, and you are required to provide the index or the permissions or the photo research and pay for them yourselves. So it kind of depends on in what level of the publishing game you are participating, because the big ones will pay for everything but then take it back from royalties. And if they've advanced royalties to you, then the advance has to be paid off before the book breaks even. And that's how they earn back their investment. And if they just earn back their investment and nothing more, they're not going to be interested in promoting the book further because they're in business and therefore they have to be able to make a profit. So those are the underlying facts about what the publishers are looking for and what they need and what the editorial boards need when they are looking at these prospectuses. So whatever you put in there, you should have in the back of your mind that these are the items or the questions that you want to reassure them on and give them information about. I sort of have been now gone through the first 2 points in my outline. I'll go through one more and then ask if there are questions about this aspect of it. Another thing that the publishers are looking for when they ask questions in your prospectus is they want to get a sense of, you know, how you're going to be to work with. Are you going to be reliable or productive? Are you going to respond to editorial advice? Are you going to respond to peer reviews? And are you going to be accurate and current and pedagogically sound? And are you going to do the proper thing with documentation? Because publishers are routinely sued. Sometimes it's a daily occurrence that they are sued by somebody from some aspect of the industry. And the bigger the publisher is, the more vulnerable they are to lawsuits. And the most common cause of suit, aside from contractual disagreements, is claims that there has been copyright infringement. So they're concerned that you really are a scholar and are really going to do the right thing so as not to make them vulnerable to lawsuits by anything that you write. So what does it mean to be reliable and productive? It means that you really are able to put aside enough time to work on this book. Textbooks are enormous projects. They're huge commitments. And it seems like a great idea often. And so you may have been sitting on wonderful ideas for a textbook for years and years. In fact, the best textbook writers are instructors who have taught the course and who have been developing ideas for how to improve the level of instruction and the quality of content and so on. And these make the most successful textbooks. But can you really do it? And are you going to do it reliably and not have writer's block or have to take a year off or whatever? And this is sometimes, it's very subjective to judge this, but it is a concern of theirs. About editorial and reviewer input, a lot of authors, particularly academic and scholarly authors, really bristle at having anybody mess with their works. It's a little bit like being a master painter and having your watercolor teacher come up and actually take a brush and write and paint on your watercolor paper or your canvas. I'm getting my metaphor mixed up. So for many, it's hard to take, but the whole point of the editorial and reviewer input from the publisher's perspective is to make the book more marketable and more competitive and more successful in its markets. And if the author is not interested in that, then they really shouldn't go to a commercial publisher. They should go to some other type of publishing model. Self-publishing, publishing with a nonprofit, you know, open access publishing, or something else, because the commercial publishers use the editorial and reviewer input to craft a book that they think can be very successful, can address a market demand, and can do it consistently over a period of time. And so your sensitivity to the, you know, your willingness to consider editorial and reviewer input is important. Another thing that many people, many authors don't realize is that the editors themselves usually are not content experts in your field, and they may receive your prospectus, and the same is true for when they receive your manuscript. They don't know what to make of it. They are not content area experts, and the very first thing they do is send it out for review. They may send it out for review to people they have on staff or a cadre of review people that they always go to for certain subject areas. And those people report back and say, yeah, this sounds like a good project. Go ahead. Or they say, not sure about this. Or they say, forget it. Or, you know, whatever they, whatever they're going to say. So the reviewer, you know, the editor might come back to you and say, well, we'd like to do this, but we are not sure about these two chapters, and we were wondering if you could also cover X, Y, and Z. And the only way they know that is from the expert reviews that they've gotten for your prospectus or for your sample chapters or whatever. And when you respond to that, your response to that lets them know whether or not they think they can work with, whether or not they're going to be able to work with you easily. Because if you give them a big argument or dig in your heels or become very defensive about what you've done, then they'll say, oh, this is going to be a problem. We'll have a hard time getting through the whole manuscript in time if this is going to be the response to suggestions. And it's not like you have to roll over and say, oh, yeah, I'll do this, I'll do everything. But there's a balance there, and it includes starting out with a positive attitude toward suggestions for changing content or organization, with the idea that, yeah, maybe it's not totally perfect what you've provided there. Maybe other people can have input that will actually help. So that openness is one of the things that they're looking for, and they try to glean that from looking at your prospectus. They also get a sense of whether or not you're really committed to accuracy and currency. They are concerned about pedagogical soundness, because if it's not, then the book will fail. This is one of the chief reasons for the failure of textbooks, and that is that they really don't teach. They're not teaching. Textbook writing really is just another form of teaching. And there are effective ways to teach and other ways that are not as effective, and so on. And that's actually also another whole topic for another conference sometime. And then, of course, you know as well as anybody why proper documentation is important. So that's kind of my input on the first three items in my outline. And now I think I'd like to see if there are any questions before I go further.
Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Robert in California, Robert Christofferson.
Hi, Robert. I think I met you once.
Yeah, at the meetings and stuff. In the proposal to take an aggressive marketing stance,
mm-hmm.
I think is really important, and I'm glad that was your first item. That, I mean, even with short reviews of the competing texts, perhaps even a spreadsheet of their failings or successes and how you see your niche, which hopefully covers a core area, the discipline, based on the reviews of what's already there. The publisher may not be aware of the competition. And
that's right.
Then the availability to go to national sales meetings could be in the proposal. The editors are really aware of academics that will write the book and drop it in, and in a few examples, not even adopted themselves because they're aloof or something. And to know that an author's willing to go explain to the sales force what their book is about, I think answers that concern that the editors will be checking on about, can we count on this fellow to turn in a document of all the features in the book or in the revision what's new in the book, and a willingness to go to the national sales meetings if that opportunity is available.
I think that's a very good point, Robert. And one of the most valuable tools that an author can provide a publisher is what is called tagging, a tagged manuscript or a tagged copy of the book. And this is where you would actually go through the book with post-it notes or whatever and flag the pages that you would want the sales staff to actually show prospective adopters.
Yeah, or prepare a document of bookmarks.
A document of bookmarks, right.
If not actually tagged.
Yes.
Described, yeah.
It's just easier for them if they actually only have to manually open to a page that's identified rather than, you know, say, go to page 23 or read from a manuscript. And, in fact, if a document is provided, then somebody in-house will go through and tag the book just to make it easier. Because the sales force, you know, those people, they're on their feet. And they're running around with, you know, many pounds of textbooks, carrying them around to the different departments. And they field easily 1,000 books in a year and therefore would have difficulty remembering all the details about all the books. Of course, they prepare for each department they go to. But anything that an author could do to help a sales rep, who also is not a content area expert, to present their book on the feet in the department, that would be helpful.
And then about the idea of signaling to the publisher that you're open to reviews, one way to signal that perhaps is to express a willingness in the proposal to have an email address in the preface of the book.
Good idea.
And the explanation being that this encourages student and faculty feedback. And where a typo is caught or a question comes up or if there's more than one email on one paragraph, then that's a signal that needs work. Once I had this has happened many times, but once the professor emails and I can see that the definition of something needs to be clarified, and so I redraft that sentence or two or paragraph and immediately send it back to the surprised, shocked professor because they're being asked to comment on the revision that they triggered. And this develops a very warm feeling, I've discovered. But the way to signal that more fluid, dynamic review process is that your email's available to sales reps, students, and professors. And I've got the leading books in my field, and the emails have never been out of hand. Maybe
that's
on a
great.
Really big week, you might get six or seven.
That's wonderful. I've also heard of some authors having, you know, developing their own websites for each of their books where instructors and students can go.
Right, or a blog.
A blog or a discussion group. Yeah.
But that
great. Those are all great ideas.
That could be in the proposal as well.
Yes, it could, and it does show not only that the author is market savvy, but also that the author is clued in about helping the marketing and sales departments to actually sell the book.
Yeah.
And win adoptions and win repeat adoptions, which is also a battle every year, because every year the competition and sometimes even the publisher itself comes out with a new edition of a directly or partially competing book. And so every year the book has to be resold so that the people who adopted it won't switch. So it's like a never-ending cycle of sales. Sales don't really end, just as authoring never really ends, because you're always fixing that sentence or fixing that paragraph or adding that topic or whatever.
This is John in Maryland.
Hi, John.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Robert, those were some really nice ideas, and thank you for bringing those up. I'm somewhat new and not so new. I'm new in the royalty side of authoring. I've done a lot of freelance, but I'm a new member of TAA and came across it. I was referred by Mike Sullivan. to look into this organization, and I've really enjoyed what I've been learning.
Right.
Now, because I'm relatively new, I'm learning as I go along, and I've been working on a project for about 2 years for a major publisher, and I'll keep it anonymous for now, but it's what they, one of their blockbuster projects.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go to a specific question, then I had a larger question you might hit in your future part of the presentation. The nuts and bolts kind of thing. Robert has a blog, and I really like that idea. I'm wondering, I've had an interest to get a website going, and just logistically getting it started and keeping it going with other full-time responsibilities. How would you recommend or suggest getting that started in a way, maybe outsourcing it to someone, and what resources might you mention it to kind of help somebody who's just getting into this
You don't currently have a website of your own?
I do not have a website, and I'd be interested in getting a website.
Your institution your college or university may very well give you a website.
One of the reasons I don't want to rely heavily on my institution's resources is that I don't want them to come back later and say,
we were part of the success.
I
hear you.
So I want to be independent as much as possible.
Interrupt here, but first of all, your publisher probably already has numerous websites that it supports for existing titles that they publish. So they have the wireframe, as it's called, probably established in-house, and the templates for the websites. And what you do is prepare a website proposal for your book that steps right into their existing infrastructure and have them sponsor the website. So I'm with Prentice Hall Pearson, so my website is printhall.com/Christofferson, and each text is on there with its cover, and then the website features I work on with someone that they hire that does that, and the blog is a link where I can update news items that happen being in Earth System Science Physical Geography. The hurricane hit, so I can put that on the site, and they don't have that up and running right now, but my website's up and running, and there's no reason for you to do this. This is part of their marketing, part of their capital outlay, part of their building in the discipline.
And you essentially provide the ideas and the specific content to put on it.
Yeah, specific,
but they will do the actual
hire
work.
Somebody that does the heavy lifting. In other words, I'll cue in things that are important, but their work for hire, arranges it, keeps things up to date, and jogs the content between different books. But that don't have your institution do it, and don't do it yourself. This is a publisher thing.
You might want to check your contract, or did it come up in your contract negotiations about your supplements?
No.
So that would be something to take up with your editor, and that is among the supplements that are going to accompany your blockbuster, presumably introductory textbook, would be things like a test bank and a study guide and an instructor's manual and a website, and just make sure that the website is on there in the agreement.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then design something unique. This goes with the sales force, the publisher, whatever, but unique things about your book, unique sets of icons, things that makes your book set apart. So on your website, design a remote control unit or some kind of entry point so it's not just a stack of folders the way websites look, but it has a neat twist to it. And I found that gets a little more institutional attention when a neat idea comes along.
You can put slides on there. You can put anecdotal things. If you make a study of academic or textbook websites, you'll just generate a list of ideas of possible things that you could do or have added to your own website. Sometimes there's a live chat feature or a poll that the students have or whatever. There's all kinds of different stuff. There are other things that can be done, but I would certainly have a website with the instructor. And also, even being independent, you should probably add your book to your own website as something that, you know, is credited to you, something that you've done, you know, in your CV and so on. You naturally would add, you can't keep your textbook a complete secret, especially, you know, your own students
hopefully
might
eventually.
Use it.
Is there a CD-ROM with your book?
Yeah. That's another supplement that you could have.
No, but if there's a CD-ROM with your book, the publishers are moving towards having it all on websites.
Yeah,
so
downloadable chapters from your book. They'll be able to go to your website and buy it chapter by chapter. Especially if you're with the, for example, are you with Cengage or something, with all those companies? You're either with Pearson or Cengage or McGraw-Hill. Those are the big ones. Maybe if it's a hard side, maybe Jones and Bartlett. Houghton Mifflin, is it?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, well,
I'm with Pearson.
Oh, okay. So
on the hard
there's side. Many different countries, yeah. Many different companies in the that are imprints within the Pearson Education family. So
Pearson sponsors over 1,000 websites.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'll be specific, and then I didn't want to monopolize, but there are other, you know, highly successful texts that have what appear to be truly independent sites.
Mm-hmm.
And they have what I would call a more innovative appeal, a little bit more creative, because they're not too standardized.
Right.
But there's certainly there's an industry standard, you know, for user interface and so on. But the design is more interesting. The look and feel is more interesting. It really feels like the author is much more involved.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't want to do the heavy lifting.
I was going to say, if you do not want to become an expert in this, then you would definitely outsource that. And there are a lot of sites for authors and for academics that offer to host your website, but they do expect you to do the work. So if you don't want to do the work, then you would need to research, service providers.
Okay.
And I can't recommend one offhand because there are millions of them, literally.
Now here was my other question. It's a little more sensitive, but now you know who the publisher is, so I was trying to protect them. But
I worked for Pearson for 12 years.
I want to say this in a friendly way because I really like them and I've been working with them for a number of years. But they did come under, and you mentioned this, and I think it's probably something that happens a lot. There are lawsuits out there for contractual related issues.
Definitely.
And Pearson just recently lost a lawsuit. It was,
yes, they did.
And it was a pretty relevant and significant one.
Very.
And here's my concern, and maybe Robert can speak to this, maybe you can or anyone else listening. I have gotten to the point where, and it's not so much Pearson, but just in general the industry, trusting that what has been agreed upon is actually what can be trusted, that it'll be the truth and reality. And here's what I'm getting at. There's an increased demand and pressure to go custom. And if there's customization, Pearson's royalty rate is a flat rate, generally speaking. That's the run-of-the-mill. It's like a 10% flat rate.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a different royalty rate that's negotiated in the contract, it's usually in the publisher's interest to go custom for a lot of different reasons, and the author suffers as a result.
Yes, the author does, and in fact, quite often the contract for customization is offered to the department or faculty member doing the customization,
ordering.
The custom.
And so, what I'm wondering, because there are different publishers now. In hindsight, it's 2020. Some publishers offer the custom is whatever the lowest agreed upon royalty rate was. If it's escalated, if it's, you know, or if it's flat. What I want to try to do is I want to feel better than I do right now about the custom situation, because it seems to me, and I'm experiencing it as a customer of one of the largest departments in the United States. We have over 18,000 students in our department annually, and so there's a lot of marketing pressure for us to go custom because it reduces competition in the used market. And this is very relevant to this conversation because it's a part of the proposal process to understand if your book is, if you're on a royalty scale that isn't, you know, the flat 10% where they are at the custom part, how do you, because some publishers actually will go with, if you have an escalated thing that starts at, say, 12%, they'll give you the 12% even if it's custom. Where Pearson goes with 10%, and I'm concerned, sometimes you get the whole book. It hasn't been changed at all. They add a bookmark in there. You know, it's whatever your universe. And
then there's seems like it's relevant to the current interest topic, but it really isn't, because this talk is about developing a prospectus. Your talk is about signing a contract and getting contractual arrangements, you know, in a satisfactory way. And I don't think that I can really address your specific issue about customization right now in my present capacity.
Okay.
And I also think that we should have a lawyer in the discussion with us to discuss that, who would be more knowledgeable.
John, this is Kim Pollack. And if you'd like, I can, you know, send you some information, some contacts that will help you with your particular problem.
Well, it's not a problem. I just was curious what the folks thought, but I really didn't want to.
Yeah.
Robert, I heard your voice.
I would also use the TA.
Well, I'm just looking at the time, and it's already past 1:30, and I didn't want to shortchange anybody.
Okay. Just on this sidebar, just one quick comment so that he will know that Pearson is signing addendums and contracts with authors where if over 70 or 80% of your content appears in the custom book, you get your full royalty rate. They're doing that with others. So if you're getting a divide-and-conquer thing where you haven't gotten the comparable full royalty rate, if the bulk of your content, call your editor and get an addendum signed immediately, because they're doing it with other authors.
That's helpful, and that's all I was really looking for.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, you can get that straightened out, and the best thing to do is to just explain to your editor what your concern is and ask if there can be an addendum to your contract that will clarify that.
Okay, wonderful. That's
especially since they lost their suit, they're looking for ways to avoid more suits, so it shouldn't be a problem.
Thank you, and I apologize if I diverted the photo.
That's okay, but one's own situations are the most compelling after all.
Sure.
But I will move on quickly to the next subject, which is what to do before writing a textbook proposal, because this is the second problem situation that I see with textbook authors, especially first-time textbook authors or new people who are new to the whole concept, and that is there are two errors here. One is some of them will actually write a textbook and then attempt to shop it. But this is not the way textbooks are done. And if anybody, and no one should feel that, no one should write a textbook before having a contract, because there's simply too much involved and it's too difficult and time consuming, and you could spend years writing an excellent textbook to see it never in print. So textbooks are signed on the basis of these proposals and sample chapters. So that's the thing to do, not write the textbook first and then find a publisher, but rather find the publisher first and then write the textbook. And I think that goes for second and third tier books as well as introductory textbooks, except possibly for conversions of scholarly works or dissertations. And even then, the proposal should come first. And then on the other extreme, I see new authors who write a proposal for a textbook. They have a great imagination, and they just out it comes, this wonderful proposal, but they haven't done any of the groundwork or the legwork. It's come only from their own minds of what they could accomplish in a textbook for their students and for other instructors who are in the classroom and so on. But there actually is a huge list of things that any author should try to figure out before writing a proposal. And the first one I listed was market research, which Robert Christofferson was referring to earlier. Your market research would be of the course. You would survey instructor syllabi who are teaching that course. How do they do it? They're the ones that you would want to buy the book or that would be adopting your textbook. So you need to see how the course is being taught currently. Because the publisher is interested in a textbook that is going to address the needs of the adopter. quite often your motivation for writing a textbook will be to radically change the field or to change the way a subject is taught. And that has to be done delicately and in small stages, because otherwise the adopter, you know, throws up his or her hands because it's too different or too strange or too difficult in light of what they've always been doing. So there needs to be a lot of consideration there. And that is what you find out when you do market research. Second, you have to do competition analysis, which Robert also referred to. And this involves identifying the books that are already out there that directly compete with yours. And the best way to do this is to compare their tables of contents, compare their features, compare their supplements, sample the reading level, so that you can see where your book would fit in. You also want to look at the internal composition of competition, other books that the publisher publishes that would be sold along with yours. And the third thing before you even do a proposal would be to make sure that you fit the author profile. And all of the publishers share certain features of an author profile. They all look, as I mentioned before, for people with institutional affiliation. They also look for people who have an appropriate rank. And this is kind of unfortunate. It's sort of discriminatory, really. But they are interested in people from associate professor up, associate professor and full professor, more so than people who are coming along. And the main reason for that is a little old-fashioned in light of changes in the way faculty are evaluated. But the origin of it was that an assistant professor was still seeking tenure, and tenure requirements frequently required a lot of publication other than textbook publication, but scholarly publication or publication in the field and presentations in professional conferences or academic conferences and symposia and things like that. So textbook writing was supposed to take a second fiddle. Now, that often is not the case nowadays, and some colleges that are not research-oriented welcome textbook authorship as a contribution to tenure-track professional activity. But still in all, many outfits like Wiley, for example, had a stipulation that anybody that was below an associate level simply was not to be approached. They maybe could do reviewing or contributing, but not as authors. So sometimes it's a blanket policy. I have no idea if they still have that policy. They did at the time that I was working with them. And on the other end, they're looking for full-time faculty, and this is very sad, but they often are discouraging toward emeriti. And this is, one of the things that's so unfortunate about it is that a lot of people who are wonderful teachers wait until they retire to write their textbook and have a harder time fielding it at that stage in their life, in their career. And this relates back to the idea that the commercial publishers want to get many editions if it's going to be a successful book. They want something that's going to be 10, 11, or 12 editions. And if you don't have another 30 years in you or 20 to 40 years in you, then they're not as interested often, at least at the introductory level. They may be perfectly happy with just two or three editions for a higher level, a graduate level book or something like that. Each company has its own level of sensitivity to the question of rank. And so that's, something to, figure out. But it's part of the steps that you take before writing a proposal, and that is making sure that you're the right sort of person to be offering this proposal in their eyes, and figure that out first. And then, of course, if you're writing a textbook, it's really critical to have taught the course. So that's another thing that can be done prior to writing the proposal. These are long-term things. The fourth thing to do before doing the proposal is the publisher research. And this is figuring out who the appropriate publishers are. And this is a very short list. These are the publishers that publish in your field at your level, that reach the adopters, that are teaching the students that you have written your book for. And that is a short list. And then you compare their lists. Some of them may have... I was just doing this the other day for somebody who's written an upper-level text on prisoner reentry, and and I was helping them place it with a publisher. And the, you know, some of the publishers cross list in their catalogs their social work list with their criminal justice list, and others have a strict separation. The book crossed several fields, and so the publishers that ended up on our short list were the ones that cross list in their catalogs the different fields, because those would give enough of a market for the book to interest the publisher, and they wouldn't discriminate against it if it fit one social work more than criminal justice or psychology or public health or whatever the fields are. So comparing the lists and seeing what their strengths are, how many products they have in the course, and do they support related courses? The more they have, the more effort they put into maintaining that customer base, and the more the more they will be selling your book. But you also don't, if they have the three top selling books for your course, you don't want them. Because their sales force is not going to want to switch from books they have been selling successfully to a new book. The publisher will ask them to, but in reality, they won't. And this is another sad truth there, and that is that the sales force does not sell all of the books that their publishers publish. They focus on the books that they have been successful with, the books that make money for them. And then another way to do publisher research is to do reviewing and contributing for publishers. And this is assistant. I always encourage people who are assistants or adjuncts or whatever and are just developing their careers in academe to hook up with publishers to do reviewing in their field and to do contributing. You know, write a supplement, write chapters, and just be, because it's a way of proving yourself. And a way of making yourself known as a reliable resource for the editors, and then it frequently will lead to a contract to write a whole work. And of course that's time consuming to do work for hire and to do reviewing, but it's a way to contribute to publisher research and to get ready to actually publish. And then, before writing a proposal, you need to have, I've called it project administration on my item 5 on my outline. If you have co-authors or if you are writing a contributed textbook, you really need to have pre-contractual agreements with them. Agreements with them before you write a proposal and enter into any kind of an agreement with a publisher. And you and your co-authors or contributors need to determine the methodology ahead of time, what the style and voice will be, and so on. And there are practical things to figure out, like what is going to be your modus operandi for getting the project done. Maybe you can develop a drafting calendar to get a realistic idea of when you think you would be able to finish a complete draft of a manuscript. And so on. So those things need to be figured out in advance. Then, of course, the obvious thing, you need to figure out what your content and organization are going to be. And this means framing a working brief TOC, or table of contents. A brief TOC is just the chapter numbers and titles. But then you have to go on to develop a drafting outline for each chapter. And then you ideally would convert your drafting outline into a table of contents with actual headings for the whole book. And this is often a surprise. A lot of authors are really surprised to discover that they're expected to have a whole book table of contents, because after all, it's a creative process, and we tend to dream up what we're going to say when, as we're writing. But your whole book TOC is needed for them to see the scope and sequence, and it is a working document that can change as you are being creative. But in the meantime, your ability to produce such a document really shows off your ability to organize your, to do your content and organization. And they can quickly see whether how it's going to stack up against a competing book by comparing your TOC with others that are out there. And it helps the editors and the reviewers to get a sense of whether or not this would be a successful book at its market. So all of the energy that you spent figuring out what you were going to say and in what order, and then converting that list into things, then that is really worth it. That is time really well spent. After you have the scope and sequence, then you would want to develop your apparatus and pedagogy. And lots of publishers will provide help with that, especially places like Pearson, the big publishers, or any of the Cengage publishers, like any of the former Thompson companies and so on, Houghton Mifflin, all of those. They will often provide assistance with developing pedagogy, because ironically, a lot of people who teach at the college level have not been taught how to teach. They have not received any formal instruction on educational psychology, and they don't know very much about the various instructional models. They sort of just do seat of pants, and of course the traditional way to do college instruction was simply to lecture. So there was no need to learn how people teach and how people learn. Even the idea of having learning objectives was strongly resisted in higher ed for many years. But gradually, the research that's done at the LHI level on cognition and on, educational psychology and so on, has filtered up and now does pervade the higher education faculties as well. So, the apparatus is basically all the elements that open and close a chapter. And you need to sort of get an idea of what those would be in advance. And then your pedagogical devices and features, the special things that you do, and these can be as simple as bold-facing key terms and having interim review questions, or it could be having a two-page spread with a special problem set or news item or, various things. It's an art to do that. They're often done badly and end up just taking up space in a book and not contributing to teaching or learning at all. But that's another teleconference right there, because that's what I spent years doing, helping people develop their apparatus of pedagogy. So I certainly can't deal with it in the next 5 minutes. And then another thing that you do in my step 7 is to develop a program of illustration or some idea of how you would illustrate your book or what illustrations would be needed, and develop a wish list for what you would have there. Your prospectus should include an estimate of how many figures and tables you expect to have, how many photos you think you would need. And of course, it's a ballpark or a working number, but you still need to have some idea. And it shows that you've thought out the development of your textbook in advance. Having said that, I should also point out that the publisher reserves all rights in how the book will look. And it's futile to get into a dispute with them about things like the palette, what colors will be in the book, or what particular design there will be for a text block or for a heading and so on, because that's their business. That's what they are in business, doing. And your business is really the content, and their business is the presentation and the cover and so on and so forth. And certainly to discuss with them and make wishes known, but not worth getting into any battles over, unless there's misrepresentation taking place. And then the last item there I have is developing your own authorial voice and style. And this is often harder than it seems. Most academic authors do not write to audience at first. They may be able to speak to audience when they're standing on their feet and talking, but as soon as they sit down to write a textbook, they end up being either too far above or too far below grade level. And I hate to say this, but a great many people in academia are not good writers, not really good writers when it comes to meeting, reaching a student audience. And you also need to figure things on your manuscript style. And as part of your practice in writing to audience and writing with your own voice and your own style, in that process, you would write and test complete sample chapters. Most prospectuses should be submitted with at least one and preferably two or even three sample chapters. And when I say test sample chapters, that would be where, the most successful sample chapters are ones that are written and then given to the students. And then the students being tested on them or having a discussion regarding those chapters. It's a good way to get a fix on how successful your sample chapters are going to be with your end users. And, of course, it's the instructors who order the text, who adopt it and order it, so they are the ones that ultimately you must satisfy. But you can still test your writing on the students. So those are the eight things that I would recommend anybody to do before even starting to write a textbook proposal, per se. All these other things have to be done first. And now let me just stop and see if there are any questions or more ideas about those 8 points before I go on to the next part.
Well, one quick thing, that the outline or complete TOC,
mm-hmm.
It is important to teach what you're going to write about in a textbook, because the crucible is the classroom, the outline is fleshed out in the classroom, and the outline translates to your H1, H2, H3 head sequence, and so those really are dynamic and can play off against each other in the writing of the chapter. I'm a little more aggressive about being involved in the design and actually seeing the full design PDF and color palette, and have found no resistance from them if I offer them a full-service author, where I want to be engaged in it. So that's an area to explore, because there may be some unique things with your book that might, you might want to be involved rather than art and marketing people who know nothing about the discipline at all. But otherwise, I thought your points were really excellent.
Oh, good. It is true that the publishers are very different in their approach to art. If they have a large in-house art department, they're more resistant to interference, let's say, what they would regard as interference. But if they are outsourcing the art program or they have a packager, then they love getting all of the input that the author can possibly provide that will help them to do justice by an art program. But there are always there are things that are technical regarding color and the printing of color and regarding fonts. I mean, there are a lot, and just manufacturing, that they might not take the time to explain, and it can lead to misunderstandings. But it'll turn out that by having something a certain way, you're adding enormously to the cost of the book, which just means that it has to earn back that cost. It takes longer to earn back that cost before you start making money on it, and so on. There might be an issue about the number of four-color pictures as opposed to black and white ones, or there might be an issue about the number of figures that you're allowed to have. There may be limits there. And these almost all relate to limits in the budget regarding production and manufacturing, rather than to a desire to thwart the author in any way. As always, there's always an explanation, often a technical one, but it's better, better to just sort of ask and, find out rather than get upset about it. I speak from experience, because I had a particular incident with an author who objected to the use of pink in her book in any form, and there were so many things that she regarded as pink that the rest of us did not think were pink. We thought they were red or orangey or, you know, this or that, but it got to be, she got terribly upset over this one particular thing, and it got out of balance. So but you're right, some of them are very flexible about it.
Hi, can I jump into the question?
Sure.
Thank you. I'm Ray in Boston.
Hi, Ray.
Hi. I am approaching emeritus status, and
uh-huh.
I'd love to write some more books. Are there workarounds around that prohibition against us? Or
absolutely. It's not really a prohibition. And as I say, all they're concerned about is that what they're mainly concerned about is that you will retain institutional affiliation and that you will be around long enough to revise the book.
What about adopting a co-author, you know? 15
yes, minutes. And they often will do that, and suggesting a co-author or putting in your prospectus that you foresee adding new co-authors over the life of several editions or with each new edition, that shows that you are that you're going to support the continued survival of your book beyond you. Usually what they do is keep adding authors, and then there'll be a clause in the contract saying that your name would be taken off of the title of the book 2 or sometimes 3 or sometimes 5 years after the death of the principal author or the original author. So they do have that all figured out. And it's in the contract somewhere that they can revise your book with or without you. But if in your proposal, Ray, you say that you would like to, you know, propose or would bring on another author for a second edition or a third edition as needed and so on, that would be good. You have already a track record in your with publication, right?
Yes, right.
So
yes, I do. I published my first textbook. I was about 60-ish.
Well, so then it shouldn't matter. And what would matter then would be how your other textbooks are doing or how they did, what their track record was, because your name will have recognition value and cachet in your field because of you've already have exposure there. So when I made that comment about emerita, I was thinking of the ones who have not published textbooks in the past and who are just starting and,
right,
you know, have retired to Cancun and they're sitting on the beach and they're writing their textbook.
Sounds good to me.
And, you know, they're going to have their 75th birthday or something like that. And, the publisher just doesn't know what to do with a situation like that. So,
I think I got 20 years in me, and then somebody else has to take it.
Well, that's wonderful. And, you know, a strategy, and in fact, I suggested this. I forget. I think I was on John Vivian's website. I had a proposal on how to breathe new life into your books. I have an article on there, and I'm basically suggesting that, bring in a co-author and go into a new textbook with a co-author, a younger person who obviously would be able to take up the standard if you decided to retire in full, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to consider.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's a good way to bring in a junior colleague or to help them develop to a point where they would be able to take over as the principal author, something like that. Okay, so, all right, then what should actually be in the prospectus? And I've made a list. I have the full CV, of course, and then the prospectus. And the prospectus includes the following things. It includes the story, and the story is sort of like an abstract. It's a little story. It's like your elevator speech. And it's brief. It's like one single paragraph. And your prospectus should really start off with that one paragraph. because the editor will either keep reading or not keep reading after that paragraph. And that paragraph is essentially saying, you know, what the book is about and why you're writing it and why it needs to be written. You know, what the goal is, the rationale and the goal. And it goes on to say what, in other words, what the topic is, what the scope is, or what the theme is. It would identify who the audience for it is and at what level of the audience it would be. So those things are all, would all be alluded to in the elevator speech. And then the editor or the, you know, the committee, whoever's reviewing it, the proposal, will say, we need a book like this, or we don't need a book like this. It would have nothing to do with the merits of the book, particularly, or I shouldn't say nothing to do, but it's far less likely to have to do with the merits of the book than its usefulness to the publisher. Will it fit in? Does it fit in with what they are doing? Do they, for example, do they go to that department, first of all? And, of course, you would already have ascertained that they do go to that department before sending the proposal. You know, how much of an effort do they make in those departments, and how many of those departments do they go to nationwide? So, you know, they either can really use your book, or they already have more than enough in that for that course already, or your book sounds like it's going to be it's going to be pitched to a too high a level for them, and they prefer to be focusing on emerging markets, such as the community college markets, which was the latest trend. Now it's online markets that are emerging. So the first paragraph is like the first paragraph in a novel that determines whether or not the reader is going to be hooked into continuing with it. So you lay it all out in that one first paragraph, that story. It can be a fairly long paragraph, but at the end, that's the paragraph that is going to get them to seriously consider your prospectus. Then you would go on and say, you know, what your apparatus and pedagogy will be and what your art and presentation will be. And you would include, as Robert pointed out earlier, you would include an analysis of your primary and secondary markets. Your primary market is the actual course that it's for, and you should identify them by name. And so after you've done your online research and looked at all the syllabi, you could just list all the courses, all the names of all the courses where your book might be adopted, because this is what the editor needs to see. They need to see all these courses they can sell this book to. Your secondary market are other people who might buy the book other than people who are actually teaching the actual course. Maybe there's a professional training places. Maybe it's a different department that's sort of like an adjunct to what you're teaching. Maybe it would be a supplement in some other course or a recommended reading in some other course. But it should still have to do with courses. A lot of instructors make the mistake of thinking that secondary markets mean people who might buy the book outside of academe. But that is a mistake. I wouldn't even mention libraries as a secondary market, because textbook publishers do not market to libraries. So even though a library might want to have your textbook, the person reading your prospectus isn't interested in that. So you wouldn't mention libraries, and you wouldn't mention bookstores or trade book outlets, because textbook publishers do not market to the trade. They market only to institutions and directly to faculty, and that's it. So any other market if you mention any other market, it betrays your lack of knowledge about the textbook publishing industry. So my advice would be only to concern yourself with institutional and academic markets when you're analyzing markets. And then in your prospectus, you would also include your competition analysis. And this shows the publisher that you looked over all the books for that course. You've compared them. You can see what their strengths and weaknesses are, and you can see how yours is better and different. and that's been spelled out. So then you would have your TOC in your prospectus, and it was interesting. You know, it is true that it's dynamic, working back and forth between your writing outline and your table of contents. But the writing outline guides the author. It's a list of what to cover in what order, and that is for the author. The table of contents are the headings for the learner, the reader. And so they have to be worded differently. They are not the same as the writing outline or the drafting outline. The headings are actually quite different. And this is an area that is much misunderstood by editors as well as by authors, because I've had a lot of struggle with it. In my book, I have a whole chapter just on crafting headings, because it turns out to be so important pedagogically. And is so easily misunderstood. But in any case, you would want to include your brief contents and a working whole book drafting outline, or if you can do it, a working whole book TOC, and that would be the best. And then you would include your sample chapters, which would be complete. You would have everything in them, all of the apparatus, all of the pedagogy, all of the references and source citations, all of the art, everything that was going to be in your sample chapters. And the more complete it is, the more impressed the editor will be, and the more confident the editor will be that you're going to be able to manage and do the multitasking that is required to actually put together a textbook chapter by chapter. And then you would have a cover letter. And in the cover letter, if I may make some suggestions, you should address the editor by name. You should include a rationale for why you chose that publisher. And it doesn't have to be something like, we think you make beautiful books. You know, it can be you have a strong list in my field, so I feel that your company would be able to present my book or sell my book the best or whatever, something practical. Then you would want to include the present status of your manuscript. Where are you with it? You have two sample chapters and two others that are in development, or whatever. And you would include the planned length of the manuscript, and this usually is the number of chapters and the number of roughly the number of words per chapter. And just as a rule of thumb, I forget which industry it is that put out this statistic, and who knows if it's still relevant now that we're all getting our instruction on iPods, but it's usually 40 book pages of reading is regarded as a maximum length for a chapter. 40 book pages is a maximum length. And I would certainly, I'd go less. Am I thinking book pages? Yes. Or manuscript? No. Yeah, book pages.
What if it's heavily illustrated?
Well, I think you could probably make allowances for the heavy illustration if it goes over that. I guess it's a rule of thumb, and so obviously if you're doing intro to biology, it might turn out to be more than 40 pages because your chapter on molecules or whatever might have to have quite a lot of illustration. So I think some books, scientific and technical books, are always bigger and heavier and take up a lot more space with illustration and white space. It also depends on whether your text is one column or two column, two column being more upper level and one column being introductory. So there's a lot of wiggle room there. But you might want to say that what your planned length of the manuscript is in terms of number of words. They'll put that in. They usually have that in the contract anyway, and they'll say how many thousands of words they want you to put in. And it's worth it to try to figure out fairly accurately, because the publisher, once they have their contract, they will have a number, and they will not want the book to go over length. It'll be very important to have the book not go over length. So whatever length you've said it's going to be, you need to come in at that. Whatever length the contract says it's going to be, you need to come in at that or slightly under, because books are bought, I don't know how else to say this, books are bought in advance. Almost everything about your book is decided in advance, even before the manuscript exists in full. The budget is built, the manufacturer is bought, the paper is bought, the signatures are bought, the number of signatures it's going to be, and so on. And all of that is upfront expenditure on the part of the publisher. That may change if we all decide to do print on demand and print these textbooks one at a time. There maybe will be a loosening of that requirement. But as it stands now, the cost of adding even a half a signature to a book after the fact, because it was over long, would add so much to the cost that they would have to raise the price even more, which would raise it to the students after the bookstore's markup. So length is just as important as schedule when it comes to meeting publishing requirements, even though they seem irrational, that the book can only be, it has to come out in even signatures or half signatures, and it can only be so many. If it's not that many, then there's a problem, because there has to be a different type of binding for that many pages, or there has to be a different quality or grade of paper or whatever, and it all gets very technical. But it all comes down to adding cost, and cost is something you don't want to add or cause to be added to your textbook, because it's bad for everybody to have higher costs. So figure out how long your book is going to be, and then plan to stick to it, because they'll make you stick to it.
Mary, one thing here, though, is that if length is really important, exactly as you've described, but for the author then to get involved in the sizing of the width and depth of each photo and piece of art in their chapter, since the author knows whether something's important or not, and an art or a layout person doesn't know what's important, and unimportant things will show up a half a page, and something really critical will show up a quarter page. So some kind of figure tracking log or author.
This is very important, and it comes up all the time.
Yeah.
But that's not going to be in your cover letter.
No, this is just, if length is an issue, then
right.
The author could say, in maintaining the importance of the length of my work, I will aggressively involve in the sizing of my photos, arts, maps, so that
that's good. And if the publisher knows you, they will understand that your use of the word sizing is not an attempt to appropriate the job of the production editor that they have on staff. So, but another way to state that, to be even clearer about it, is to say that you will submit art specs that will suggest sizing that will contribute to maintaining length. They would love to have art specs for every piece of art, and you can put in recommended size. If your book is too long, your art and photos will end up as very small things in the margins, because they won't be able to. So the point is to keep the text within to keep your text within the limits in terms of length.
This is where two column works well to control length, because you have more flexibility in importing your figures.
Right. If you can have a two column design, and the thing that will determine whether or not you can have a two column design will be if the other books that are in your market have a two column design. If they do, yours will. If they don't, yours won't, because it will be perceived as not competitive in that market. It will be a different market. So if they, it's very market-driven whether or not it's one or two columns. A two-column book is higher level, for instance. And so if they're trying to reach a lower-level audience, if you'll pardon the expression, they'll want to try to maintain a one-column book. Also, the number of columns has to be decided in advance before there's manuscript. So it's not really a fix after the fact. It's rather a decision that's made up front about the book design. And the book is designed on the basis of the sample chapters. So when you submit sample chapters, if you submit the prospectus with the sample chapters, if the reviewers come back and say this is a good project, and they get you under contract, one of the first things that happens is that those two sample chapters that you sent in with your prospectus are sent out for design. And a design is built on the basis of them, which is another reason for having your sample chapters be as close to, you know, final as you can, with everything in it, nothing missing, everything in them. So, and it's at that point that it will be decided whether or not it's going to be a one-column or a two-column book. Now, I think if you've had a long relationship with a publisher and many titles with them that have made them a lot of money, they're certainly going to be a lot more flexible in dealing with you. And I'm happy to see that that's been the case for you, Robert, because it isn't always. So it's very good that it's worked with for you, and that they can count on you to give good input on the physical aspects of the book, which is really great. And I I remember working on a psychology book, and the information processing diagram that is standard to all those books, they printed so small you couldn't even read the labels. And then they had, I believe it was Maslow's hierarchy, which they probably don't even put in psychology books anymore. And it was a whole page. Can you imagine a full page with that silly triangle with self-actualization at the tippy top? So it is true that the people need guidance on how to size the artwork. And what I do is to send the authors a spec sheet and ask them to use the spec sheet. And the spec sheet has a place there saying, what size it should be. If it should be a quarter page or less, you know, or a half a page or more. But the actual sizing is in terms of picas. And the production editors figure that out. So what you're doing is just giving them sort of a ballpark idea of what the size should be.
But buy a pica ruler.
You have a pica ruler? I am so impressed.
We find a company that we buy them six at a time and then wear them out.
Good for you. That's excellent. Well, boy, I wish I had been working with you when I was at Pearson.
when you have your two-column length, the first thing I always check is that there's a 1.5 pica separation down the middle between.
Oh, good for you.
Somebody tries to jack that out to two or three picas, and they're costing you words.
Yep, they are. Good for you.
Listen,
wow.
The comment about art is that if you have an idea that there are, let's say, four complex arts in a chapter, or six, or five.
Uh-huh.
Before you even start writing, just like you do your TOC, sketch those arts out.
Absolutely.
Sketch the labels. Have the art draw a label manuscript with the spellings, and then a comment page, three
mm-hmm.
pages for one piece of art. And the labels usually go where students have asked you questions while you were teaching from your draft art, but
mm-hmm.
then build the words, and that way the art is integrated with the words. The most common thing I find is authors write a chapter and then go back and stick the art in.
Yeah.
And
yep.
So just like you do the TOC in advance, I would get color pencils and ink and sketch out your complex arts.
Yep.
At least map your simple arts.
Good idea, and do it as you go.
As you go.
And insert it right with your, that's really excellent. Now, nowadays, of course, people might be doing that online, Robert, instead of with colored pencils. They might be doing it with their graphics program. And in fact, even your word processing program has a graphics interface that will enable you to make simple things that an artist can then render for you. But they love to get them electronically because they're easier to manipulate then, and the artist has something to work with instead of having to do everything from scratch.
Yeah, the renderings do go to a computer artist, so you don't.
Right.
I'm not saying you draw out the ones that are in the book. You draw your input out.
Right.
The computer artists, unfortunately, with extreme literal interpretation.
Oh, I know.
Redrafts it. You draw a little turd in the sky, and you get the computer art back, and there's a little turd in the sky. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And for technical areas in particular, you do need to be very vigilant about the art, no question about it. You also have to be careful about how humans are rendered in the art, although most publishers have policies about that and are fairly rigorous about it. But still in all, it can be. I remember a book I worked on that just had the most horrible-looking humans. It was unappealing, but it was very difficult to get the publisher to change the artist that they had, because that's also a contractual arrangement. So it ends up being a very complex collaboration among a great many experts, most of whom never even see each other. But it does make for a complex enterprise, for sure. So, well, to finish the topic, the last thing to include in your cover letter would be complete contact information. And this is quite often left off. So even if there's a letterhead, you would still want to say, you know, I'm available on Tuesdays and Wednesdays from 1 to 5 at the following number, and I can be contacted by email anytime at this email address or something like that. Because that it not only encourages them, it lets them know, you know, about your accessibility, because this authors sometimes do make themselves inaccessible, much to everybody's dismay, and of course editors do the same thing for different reasons, you need to show that you are going to be accessible, and it will also encourage them to respond. Once you've submitted the prospectus, of course it takes a while, and what's happening during that time, they should at least acknowledge receipt. And if you don't get acknowledgement of receipt of your proposal within a couple of weeks, you should email them and say, did you receive it? Just to make sure that it was received and got to the right person, the right party. And a lot of the editors now want electronic submissions. So both your cover letter and your prospectus and your sample chapters would all go as email attachments. And they would go only after you had queried them to find out if they wanted to see these things. And then if they answered back saying, yes, we'd like to see your proposal, then you would email them that and all of the attachments. And then what's happening in the subsequent weeks is that it's all been generated into hard copy and or forwarded to their review, the people they use for professional reviewing. And, their confidants, the ones that let them know or tell them whether or not they should publish something. And those people are reading the proposal and are getting back to the editor and saying, get this person under contract. Or they're saying, not sure about this, or this would be good if there were the following changes, or, the author needs to think more about what to include in sections 8 and 9 or something like that. Or they'll say, we don't think that this is right for you. What not to include in a prospectus, I guess that's my next subject. And did I list them in your outline, or is that only in my outline, what not to include? I don't remember.
Yes, we have it here in the outline.
You do, okay.
Manufacturing media and rent.
Right. So I listed a few things there. I have seen proposals fail because the author got into one of these items in too much detail, and it just sort of put off the editor, because these are not the things that are important that the editor needs to know in order to offer you a contract, or for the publisher to know in order to offer you a contract. And they don't want to discuss money up front before they have accepted the manuscript. So, the thing to do there would be to wait until they say, we want to publish your book, and then you say, well, okay, then what are you offering me? Then that would come up. And if you didn't like what they were offering, then you would just go on to the next publisher on your shortlist and send that editor a query letter, would you like to see my proposal? And then send it and then see. It's a little, it's time consuming, And none of them wants to have multiple submissions because of some of them are paying, you know, the people that are reviewing are being paid. So, you know, they don't like the idea that they may be spending hundreds of dollars on something that you also sent to somebody else at the same time. So they sort of have to be able to go through it one at a time. And it's more time-consuming, but more fair to everybody, really. And it still leaves the author in a position to negotiate for their grant or their advance or their royalty. Although I will say grants are pretty much becoming a thing of the past. They just aren't doing them anymore. The publishers are all sort of, even the big ones, are suffering in one way or another and are having to change the way they do business. And one of the things they're doing is not giving grants, reducing or not mentioning advances against royalties, although with textbooks, advances against royalties are so customary that there's just no getting around it. And but what they'll do is step them. For example, they'll say, "Well, we'll give you this much when you have upon signing of the contract." Then we'll give you this much when you have completed first draft. Then we'll give you this much when you have turned around the final page proof or something like that. So that they essentially spread out their risk by breaking up the advance against royalties into different stages. Okay, are there any questions about what should be in the proposal? What to include in the proposal and what not to include in the proposal.
Mary Ellen, I just wanted to very quickly, just to make sure I understand correctly the procedures, if I can call it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So first, you recommend to send a query letter asking in general if they would be interested to see my proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And only after that sent the proposal. Is that correct?
Yes. First of all, you would identify the correct editor by name,
right,
who should see your work, and then you ask them, "Would you like to see my work?" And
right,
in there you put your elevator speech, you know, your story.
Uh-huh.
So this is and because that's how they would know whether or not they want to see it.
Right. So do not just attack them right away with attachments.
There are some academic publishers that have submission guidelines that have you submit a proposal to a editor at somebody.com. That's up to you if you go to that type of publisher. But those are smaller presses. They might be specialty presses. Their review process is different from the usual textbook publishers, who are the larger commercial publishers. And you always want to go with the as high end as you can with your project initially, and then go to the other ones if you don't find enough interest in where you've looked. By and large, you would query the person by name,
mm-hmm,
rather than just make a blind submission like a magazine article submission or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much. This is very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. And then I'm so sorry for going over the limit. I just looked at the clock and saw how late it is. I'm really sorry. I won't go into any further detail. I think the last one was what are the hallmarks of the winning proposals, and I've listed them. And you need to reach the right person at the right time, one at a time. And it's important to get the right editor's name. They do their signings in the spring and fall, not summer or winter. And you want to sign a contract giving you a couple of years, if it's a first edition book, a couple of years to draft. But you would want it so that it could be completed in the fall for a spring you know, for a spring semester, so that it doesn't actually have to be quite that close. But usually books will go into production in the fall and come out as manufactured books in the spring. Then they're sampled and promoted over the summer, and you know, they're in the instructor's hands by fall, where they make their choices for the next semester, because there has to be this long lead time, because instructors have to have, you know, 3 or 4 months or a whole semester or more in advance for the following semester.
Yeah, early in stock, like January, February of
2008, right.
But it's got a 2009 copyright.
That's right. So the copyright date and the date that the book is actually in the bookstore are two different things, utterly. And also a book with a 2009 copyright might be in the hands of instructors in 2008, because they haven't made their adoption decision yet. They have to be able to make their adoption decision. So the book is actually published well before its copyright date.
One question I wanted to ask you about what you think of this idea to have in the proposal is that to show proactivity on the part of the author and to show a concern for efficiency in proofing, copy editing, and accuracy, I've always suggested that authors prepare a style guide specific to their book, you know, loosely based.
That's an excellent idea.
Chicago Manual of Style 15th Edition or something, and that style guide guides all the people that have their hands on the manuscript. Is that something to put in the proposal to help encourage the editor?
Sure. Yep. Yep. The more details you can include along those lines, the only thing you want to acknowledge is that there's a house style as well. So whatever style you pick would be secondary to whatever style the publishing house itself has for its own, under its own imprint.
Well, I wished it was that formal at their end. We found that having a style guide kind of filled a void, that every
really?
Copy editor had their own style.
Uh-huh.
And, for instance, having Earth as a proper noun without the article the. This was a fight 18 years ago to get them to do that instead of saying the Earth as a common noun.
Oh, interesting.
But they adopted that, so they altered their in-house policy.
Right, but they do have in-house styles, and what it is is a big document with long lists of words saying how they should be treated, and long lists of punctuation showing how the punctuation should be used and whatever. And that certainly can be altered or modified, but all publishing houses do have some kind of a house style that they've developed.
Ask for their guide then to help.
Yeah. It would be good to, you know, once you get a contract, there's a whole list of things that you should expect to receive from the editor and should demand if it isn't forthcoming. And one of those is a copy of the house style document so that you can, you know, employ it as much as possible. And if not, and otherwise, you know, point out exactly where it should be changed. And certainly presenting your own style and asking for consistency in an editorial style is a very good idea.
Right. But put that in the proposal, or is that getting too pushy?
Well, I don't know. It's not that it's getting too pushy, but it might be putting the cart before the horse. In other words, if you get too much into the details of how you will conduct your business before they have expressed an interest in publishing your book, you know, it might not have the effect that you want it to have. But it would depend on the context, I think. If you had it in a paragraph that was a short paragraph that was designed to show this about you as an author, that could be an item or an element within it. But I wouldn't just throw it in there. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Mary Ellen, what are some other items you mentioned? There's a list of things you might want to ask for during or after the proposal. And one of them was a copy of the house style document. Are there some others that you think are common, independent of the field, that you want to ask for that shows initiative and knowledge of what you're doing?
Well, you know, they would. That's a very good question. And to tell you the truth, I was really thinking of myself in the role of a development editor, which is almost like an author. I mean, it's, you know, it's like being the author without having your name on the cover, but in some ways. But that's one of the ways that it's different. I'm sure there are other ways. But the things, when I'm asked to develop a textbook, I ask for copies of the three leading competing books, a copy of the House Style, as I mentioned, a copy of all correspondence that was with the author that was related to that book, a copy of the prospectus that was sent in, of course, a copy of the sample chapters, a copy of all the reviews that were done of that book, and a copy of the reviewing plan if the editor has one. Quite frequently they hire me to develop the reviewing plan. Sometimes they already have a reviewing plan in place, so a copy of that. And you know, essentially anything that is going to help me to give them what they want in a short time and therefore, you know, provide them with value for their money. So, and I think that an author should ask for the same sorts of things, whatever they might be. And if you had any questions at all about their policies or procedures, I would ask them up front. And as they came up, I would ask. Just so as to stay on top of things and stay informed, because a lot of time can be wasted just through really simple, silly things that are easily avoided if people would had simply communicated. So communication, and I think everybody acting in good faith and everybody communicating fully at an appropriate time, those are the key things to do there. But I'll confess, John, was it, that I was thinking more of my work than of the author when I said all the things that the editor should send you. But you certainly, I mean, what they'll send you as an author, they'll send you the author's questionnaire, which is how they begin their marketing effort. And marketing begins as soon as the contract is signed, before... We used to call it vaporware. It's like it doesn't exist yet, but there's a whole lot that's done for a book before it exists. And they'll send you a copy of the author guidelines, and the author guidelines will include your instructions to you on copyright to make sure that you are up on the copyright law. They'll include basic rules that you should follow regarding copyright. It will give you instructions for how to prepare your manuscript. There will be a manuscript preparation guide, and some of them are very prescriptive. They'll tell you how wide your margin should be, what font you should use, what size font, in order to generate your manuscript. And they'll have instructions on how to insert your figures and tables and how to indicate your photo specs and so on. So it's like a complete author's guide to how to produce your manuscript, and they should send that with the contract. So,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. And there are probably other things. It's just that I can't think of them right at this very moment. But anyway, the hallmarks of winning proposals are pretty clear. Where it says say what the publisher needs to hear. Those are the things that, you know, we've been talking about. What the publisher needs to hear is, yes, there is a market for your book. Yes, you are market savvy. You do understand the publisher's needs. And if possible, if you can educate yourself about the challenges that the publisher faces and the costs and the risks that the publisher undergoes, you know, that's always helpful. The publisher needs to hear that your book is going to be competitive or have a competitive edge. They need to hear that you're well qualified to write it and that you're well positioned to represent it. They need to hear that you expect to revise, that you're going to work to length and to deadline. And, you know, then you're showing them through your sample chapters that you can organize content coherently and that you can write. And the language that you're using should convey your commitment and your enthusiasm because they know that it's such a daunting task and it's such a long-term task. It really is a mission, and you need to have you need to be sort of an evangelist for what it is you are doing it just in order to get yourself through it. It's one of those life-defining experiences, and I think Robert and those of you who are already textbook authors would sort of agree with that. It's a very life-defining task to write textbooks.
It's wonderful that way.
It is. It is wonderful that way. It's a wonderful way to. It's a way of life, actually, and it's a wonderful way of life.
That's why you've got to have a home office or writing studio.
It's a business. You make a business out of it, and you need to treat it as a business if you really get into textbook writing.
Too much time away from family.
There are ways to integrate family into the process, and I always try to help the authors that I work with, I always try to help them do that. And there are various tricks that you can do and so on that works. It depends, like, on the ages of the children and on the background of the spouse and so on, but there are ways to get everybody involved, your family, your students, and so on. And, of course, now with Wiki textbooks on the horizon, the students are going to be more involved than ever before. I think my last – I'm trying to close now because I see how late we are, but when and to whom to send your package, and it's just you have to find the right house, it has to be the right editor, and you have to submit it at the right time. Those are the three elements that will most influence the reception for your proposal. And the proposal that the likelihood that your proposal would be accepted is actually quite high. Proposals that are right, they're accepted. If you've reached the right person in the right house at the right time with the right product, i.e., a product that they feel is marketable and competitive and authoritative, then they will sign it. And it won't matter if they have other books on the same subject even for the same course, because they will market the book in successive years so that each time a new edition comes out, that's the book that will get sold. And then when your book comes out again in its second edition, that's the book that everybody will be instructed to sell that book that year. And this is not necessarily a good thing, because the publisher's sales forces are constantly bouncing people back and forth among textbooks. But as teachers, have you not always switched textbooks from semester to semester? Or have you found one that really, really works and that you've been loyal to semester after semester, regardless of other offerings? There's a huge difference out there in terms of what the loyalty factor is as opposed to what the dissatisfaction is that academic people or on-the-feet classroom teachers will frequently have with textbooks and want to change them. So, the textbooks are a big market. It's still profitable, even with the used textbook industry and the online textbook industry, it's still a very profitable business. I think the future is going to be is that you will be developing not so much textbooks as a whole as developing content, and authors will be selling their content for multiple uses, many of them online. But this is still, it's still in the future. It's still coming, for better or for worse, still coming. I would not be discouraged at all if you've done the groundwork and the legwork to prepare to write the proposal, and then if you've written a good proposal, and if you've gotten that proposal to the right people at the right place at the right time, you're going to get a contract offer.
Sometimes if you have a local rep submit a market report, dog it a little bit, because they get a credit, they get a bonus or a...
Yes, they do. And in fact, some, like Pearson, that's how they get their textbook proposals. You can't even get the name of the correct editor to send it to. You have to go through the field rep. And the best way to get your proposal before the eyes of the right person is to talk to the people who come to sell you textbooks in your office and say, I am writing a textbook proposal for this course X, Y, or Z. Who should I contact at the home office? And the field rep either will give you the name and contact information of the editor to contact, or the field rep will say, send it to me, send your proposal to me, and I will field it. And, if, for example, Pearson does it that way, and I believe Cengage does also. They then your proposal goes to the salesperson, and the salesperson presents it to the editor, and the salesperson gets a bonus or a credit or a percentage or something like that as part of their reward system. So the first people to check for who to contact would be the sales reps and your published colleagues who already have contacts with editors. And those would be the two best sources. The editors are not on the websites. The editors' names very seldom are listed on the websites. Their identities are, carefully guarded and protected. And also, there's tremendous turnover in that field. Editors, the only way that they can advance is to leave. There is no other way to advance within the publishing industry. It's a very dysfunctional aspect of that particular industry, but there may be one level of promotion within a company, but then you would have to leave in order to get a different position or go to a different list or whatever.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.